All right. Good morning again. The court calls United States v. Merritt. Counsel for the appellant. Good morning.
Good morning, Senior Judge Efron, Judge Baker, members of the court. Pleasure to see all of you again. Your Honors, as you know, we are here to address two issues. The first of those is that appellant's conviction for viewing child pornography violates his constitutional right to fair notice for his alleged offense, occurred in 2006, but Congress did not criminalize the intentional viewing of child pornography until 2008. The second of which is appellant's due process right to a timely appellate review was violated where the Air Force Court decided his case 1,024 days after it was docketed, which was nearly 6 months after his court martial ended. Chief Judge, subject to any preferences of the court, I was going to address the issues in the order in which they are addressed in the brief. So starting with assignment of error one. As a matter of due process, an appellant must have fair notice that their conduct is punishable before the government can charge him under Article 134. As this court knows, pursuant to U.S. v. Vaughn, there are six sources of notice delineated. The first of those, and I will address each of those as they relate to appellant's case, the first of those, of course, is the manual for courts martial. And as this court knows, the mere viewing of child pornography is not prohibited under the manual for courts martial.
You're going right to sources of notice. Can you address as a threshold whether the parties agree on a basic standard of what fair notice consists of?
Well, you mean?
And by that I mean, not do they agree on whether page 93 of the manual says X or Y, but in your view, do the parties agree, for example, that a normal intelligence person has to have a reasonable opportunity to know what is prohibited? Is that a statement of law that the parties would agree on?
I don't
or not?
Agree with this, Judge.
Okay, and of course you can only speak for yourself, but I'm trying to figure out whether we're all starting at the same place or whether if we started at a different place, what happens? And do you agree that fair notice also would require that whatever the law is has some standards by which you can measure people enforcing the law could follow it?
Absolutely, Judge.
Okay, and now you're going to say, now where might we find those things, and you're moving on to your list.
Yes, Judge.
Okay, but I want to know where you were starting.
Sure, and I think that all the parties would agree, Judge, that U.S. v. Vaughn is the framework, and that the framework lists out these six elements, that I'm going to describe for you. The second of which is federal law. As we know, the Child Pornography Prevention Act was enacted, as of 1996, had an exhaustive list of prohibited conduct. And I've listed those in my brief, no need to go through all of them, but they include possession, manufacturing, promoting, etc. of child pornography. The mere viewing of child pornography was specifically not included. Now, the government counsel, and this is, I believe, Chief Judge, where we start to differ, is the government says, well, it's inextricably intertwined with the other elements or with the other sources. I would argue that it is not, or else the government, Congress would not have amended the Act in 2008 to prohibit the accessing with the intent to view child pornography, but still not prohibiting the mere viewing of child pornography. And candidly, members of the court, I believe it makes sense to do it that way. Because if you look at it, there are several reasons why the mere viewing of child pornography may not be criminalized, and why the Congress may have intentionally decided to leave those off of the list. For example, the Air Force Court in this case had to view child pornography in order to conduct a factual sufficiency review.
But the specification, does it not say knowing and wrongly?
It does.
So no one is suggesting, are they, that a court that is performing its, I hope not, is performing its lawful functions is wrongly doing it?
No, not what I'm alleging at all, Judge. But it goes to, for example, the second one. And I think that this would be the more relevant example for the court to consider. I think this court has seen numerous cases in which a roommate or a spouse stumbles upon their roommate or spouse viewing child pornography. It would be counterproductive for the court or for the Congress to set a time limit on, you know, when a roommate sits at a computer and says, my roommate is viewing child pornography. At what point in that viewing by the other roommate does he have to step back and say, okay, now I can't view it anymore because now it's wrongful? Is it 20 seconds? Is it 60 seconds? Is it 5 minutes? And we would be going down a slippery slope in trying to decide how long one may review child pornography before reporting it. Along those same lines, judges, there are no federal cases on point. The government and the Air Force Court cited two cases that are simply in opposite to what we are determining in this case, and that is Pruitt and Bass. Finally, judges, as it relates to federal law, the question is, would a reasonable person know that the mere view...
Now, why isn't Pruitt on point?
Well, because the mere, because Pruitt dealt with receipt of child pornography.
But it defined receipt, which you may or may not agree with, as to take in through the mind or senses.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Pruitt defines receipt as taking in through the mind or senses.
Correct.
So they define it in a way that suggests that receipt and viewing may be the same thing, or could be the same thing. So why, that doesn't answer the question, but why isn't that relevant to our analysis here?
Because we don't know in Pruitt whether they were criminalizing, for lack of a better term, the receipt or the viewing. The court simply doesn't make it clear.
I mean, what about the fact in this case that the person was charged with receiving and viewing? I'm not sure you argued this, but isn't it hard to figure out what viewing means if receipt is being separately charged?
Well, I think it's part and parcel of what I am arguing, Judge, which is...
But you seem to be making an abstraction that if you can't find the word viewing in the law anywhere, then there's no notice. But what about the fact that to the extent you can find receiving in the law, he's already been charged with receiving, so that leaves us to ask the question, what's left to charge him with?
Well, and as you'll recall, Judge, the defense specifically made not only a motion to dismiss the charge on the grounds that there was no fair notice, but also on the grounds that it would be essentially, for lack of a better term, multiplicious for finding purposes because they were one parcel of the same offense. And the military judge specifically said no.
Counsel, yes, with regard to that, there could be an argument that it was an unreasonable multiplication of charges under the rules if the same act were charged both as receiving and viewing. Is that an issue on this appeal?
Well, Judge, I think the fact that A, the judge denied that motion, and B, I think more importantly, the fact that for sentencing, the judge says, I'm merging these offenses, but she did not dismiss one. So I do believe it's relevant on this appeal in the sense that he now stands convicted of two separate and distinct offenses.
I understand that. I understand the argument that's being made by both parties in terms of the relationship of the two charges. My question is the issue of an unreasonable multiplication of charges at issue on this appeal?
It is not an issue that we briefed or that the court granted, if that's what you're judging.
Yeah. So in this case, how does that cut? That is, let's assume that for purposes of this appeal, it's not an unreasonable multiplication of charges. Does it help or hurt the defense that it appears that the same or transactions were involved in both charges?
Well, I think that, Your Honor, if I understand the court's question correctly, if this court were to determine that specification one is, as we claim it is, that there was a lack of fair notice and dismisses the charge, then the remedy, if I understand the court's question, I believe I'm answering the court's question, the remedy, in our opinion, would be to reassess the sentence or to send it back rather for a sentencing rehearing. So I believe it helps the defense that the court at the trial level found that it was not an unreasonable multiplication of charges because the accused now stands convicted, A, of two completely separate and disparate offenses as the court determined at the trial level, and perhaps more importantly, he stands sentenced of two separate and distinct offenses.
I thought you said the judge merged them for sentencing.
She merged them for sentencing, but she did not.
Well, then where's the prejudice?
Well, because she did not dismiss the other charge, the viewing charge, Judge.
But if he wasn't punished for it,
well, we don't know
my reading of the judge's maximum that it came up with was that it was based on the receipt.
I don't believe that. I would disagree with that, Judge. In my opinion, the defense's opinion, what she did was she said, I'm going to take these two charges, merge them, and I will go with the maximum term as it is for the receipt. But it's not as if the viewing simply went away. I mean, he was still punished for viewing, albeit part of that 20-year maximum punishment.
Can you identify a case in which charges were merged for purposes of punishment and then subsequently one of the charges was dismissed on appeal, and then there was any either reassessment or rehearing under those circumstances when there had been that merger for sentencing.
Judge, I did not cite a case in my brief. I will quite candid with the court that I did not look for any, but I certainly know, I'm trying to think of whether or not that is the scenario that happened in one of my cases from last term, and I'm losing track of whether or not
it was. I understand the argument on prejudice, that there's prejudice from the existence of a conviction, and the existence of that conviction could be prejudicial if, for example, on further clemency-type review or habeas, the receipt were, one of those charges were, the receipt was dismissed, you'd still be left with a viewing conviction. So I can understand the prejudice there. I'm having a little more difficulty finding the prejudice on the sentence given the judge's determination in this case.
Well, Judge, and let me address the first one of those questions. First one of those scenarios first, because it goes into the second issue that I'm going to be discussing very briefly, which is, for example, numerous states, your sex offender registration depends upon the number of convictions you have.
Right.
So we have. So I think that also addresses the first part.
I understand that. I understand the prejudice from the conviction. I'm asking about where would there be a basis in our precedent or otherwise for finding prejudice when there's been a specific determination that offenses are merged. On sentencing.
And again, Judge, I would have to simply go back and say that it's not as if she said, I'm disregarding the viewing completely. I mean, obviously, in her calculation of what the punishment should be, she punished him for receiving and for viewing. Or else she would have said, I've had numerous cases, this court had read numerous cases, in which the judge says, I'm not going to punish him for this offense. But that's not what the judge said. She still punished him. Perhaps he would have gotten a lesser term of confinement. Perhaps he would have gotten no VCD had he not been convicted of the viewing. We simply don't know.
Does all that have to do with notice?
That's the question the judge has. And so if
the issue here that you're talking about is whether or not there was proper notice.
That is correct, Judge.
And what is the remedy if there wasn't notice?
Then it's dismissal of the charge and, in our opinion, reassessment of the sentence.
And is there an issue there as to whether or not they were prejudiced by that arise in a normal analysis of that?
Prejudice as to the finding or as to sentence, as I was just discussing with Judge Epstein?
Well, prejudice as to the lack of notice. I mean, if a court determines there was a lack of notice, where does the analysis go from that point?
If the court determines that there was a lack of notice, then it's a violation of due process and the charge is dismissed. Judges, if I may very briefly, I'd like to discuss the appellate delay in this case. The appellant's due process right to a timely appellate review was violated where the Air Force Court decided this case 1,024 days after it was docketed, nearly 6 months after this court martial ended. Judges, I would just like to talk about 3 dates and then jump to the issue of prejudice with the court's indulgence. As you know, members of the court, the accused was sentenced on 24 September 2009. This case was docketed on 24 February 2010. The brief was filed by the defense on 16 February 2011. A decision from the Air Force Court came out nearly 2 years later on 14 December 2012. Total time from docketing of this case at the Air Force Court was 1,024 days. The total time from sentencing was 1,199 days. As the Air Force Court correctly concluded, this is facially unreasonable according to Barker versus Wingo. As the court also knows that there were several reasons for the delay and during the time, I don't believe it's necessary that I go through all of those, but I would like to highlight a couple of them. And the main one that I would like to highlight, Your Honors, the government chides the defense for not exerting our right to a speedy post-trial review while at the same time saying that our request for expedited review mooted the issue. We could not disagree more strongly with that assessment. Since when, according to this court's law, does the assertion of a right moot a remedy? The government argues that 477 days of the court review is attributable to the defense, and we simply disagree. The appellant, as I was just discussing with Judge Efron, with Senior Judge Efron, was prejudiced by this delay.
What's your best prejudice argument?
I have two, Judge. One is that if this court were to set aside the findings as to charge one, then A, the sex offender registration would likely be more limited than it is now because many states do limit sex offender registration depending on the number of convictions. Two, and I think most, perhaps more importantly, Your Honor, as it relates to Moreno, is the constitutional cognizable anxiety. The appellant's life has been in complete limbo since these charges. And you don't need any specific evidence other than to know that he doesn't know for how long and if he is going to have to register as a sex offender. If this, and as you know, we raised all of these issues before the court as it relates to both specifications and charges. Your Honor, my time's up.
If you were to cite to a law or a state law that predicates sex registration on the number of offenses, what would you, if you're pointing and illustrating your point to us, what law would you point to?
No, Judge, I thought about this last night, and I was hoping you weren't going to ask me that question because I don't have them in front of me. I know of them.
But it's not intuitive, without someone citing to specific laws, that someone who is convicted of receiving child porn isn't going to have to register, and instead the state's going to count up the number of child porn charges to make that determination. And if you're going to make that assertion, you ought to back it up.
I thought about it last night. I didn't have a chance to rebrief it. I would be happy to follow up with a brief to the court if the court would so like. But I do recognize, Judge, that I, do not have a source with me. If I may address the other issues, Judge Erdman, very briefly as it relates to the other question that you had asked of prejudice.
Quickly.
Very quickly, Judge. The limits on a possible retrial, we are now 7 years from trial. So if this court were to send specification of charge 2 or specification 2 back to trial level, the appellant's ability to defend himself would be severely limited. And as this court knows, that even if there is no specific prejudice, there is still the due process violation absent some action from this court dealing with this excessive unreasonable delay. There is simply no reason for the government or the Air Force Court to clean up its act. For any further mention, questions, that concludes my question, my presentation. Thank you,
counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Baker, Senior Judge Efron, members of the court. I'm Colonel Don Christensen, and I, along with Mr. Roger Bruce, represent the government in this case. Judge Baker, you asked what is the standard to look at in this case, and the government would concur, it is, we know this, and that was put out in the Saunders case, where this court said fair notice of the criminality of the conduct charged as service discredited under Article 134 is what we should be looking at. More specifically, Saunders specifically said that this court should look at whether or not a notice is placed, whether it's something out there that has placed a reasonable military member on notice that his conduct is criminal under Article 134. Now, a little bit later in Saunders, this court noted that there's a core concept of criminality that we must look at. And in that case, which was a case dealing with bigamy, I believe. My mind just went blank on that. But they looked at state law. And in that state law, they looked at there was a number of different ways that each state was addressing that. But every state addressed the issue in question to some degree.
What is the relevance of state criminal statutes to a military, federal, purely federal offense occurring outside the United States?
Well, I think it's clear that the precedent of this court has said that state statute, repeatedly, there's said state statutes can be looked at. I agree with the appellant. State statutes can be looked at to provide notice. And that notice occurs overseas as well. The bond court made it specifically clear. In that case, it was a child neglect case, where they looked at state statutes dealing with child neglect. The crime occurred in Germany. She was not charged as an assimilated crime act, so it was not a jurisdiction issue. And they said that the state statute does provide that notice.
How many states have to have a statute before it provides sufficient notice? I mean, in that case, is it preponderance of the states?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's what's interesting is that there has been no bright line rule by this court or any court to establish how many states have to do that. I would note that when we were talking about the bigamy statute in the Bivens case, there they were only able to rely on two states that specifically made it a crime for a single person to marry someone who was already married. all the other state statutes made it a crime for a married person to marry somebody else who was either married or single at that time. And so this court has gone down to as little as two states to provide that. But it's the government's position, when we go get that core concept of criminality, it's not just whether or not it's seven states or 11 states that have made it specifically a crime to view child pornography back in May of 2006 when the accused committed these crimes. There is obviously, and this accused was on notice, excuse me, this appellant was on notice, obviously our society has taken a very strong stand against child pornography. Every state in 2006 outlawed child pornography to some degree, whether it's receipt, possession, manufacturing, distribution, or viewing.
What about the distinction between receiving and viewing? If he were just charged with viewing or just charged with receipt, you'd have a pretty strong argument that if you were a military member in 2006 and you didn't get the memo about don't mess with child porn, you probably should have been on notice. But what about on notice that there is something different about receiving it and viewing it, that that's in fact I'm engaging now in two criminal acts? How would a normal person understand that?
Well, I would say a normal person would understand it this way, Your Honor. First, we have a chain of distribution, the manufacturing to the viewer. The viewing is the consuming. Everything else is how we get it to that person. Viewing is using child pornography. It makes absolutely no sense for a reasonable Arabic to believe that it was against the law to manufacture, it was against the law to distribute, it was against the law to possess, it was against the law to deliver, it's against the law to receive, but I could use child pornography. It's just fine for me to use.
Okay, so we're supposed to imply mens rea. You've got this parade, this panoply of gerunds here. Receiving, transmitting. You know, it goes on and on and on, and Congress didn't include viewing. You're talking federal notice here. You can talk all you want about state X and state Y does this, but when this guy did this, you had this panoply of gerunds in the statute, and there's nothing in there on viewing, and Congress later plugged that hole. Now, how do you answer that?
Well, I answered it, Your Honor, that this court has answered that. As Mr. Cassara pointed out, there's six things that this court has established that can provide that notice. One of them being state statute.
Get off the state statutes and talk to what I'm asking.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know how to get off it other than that this is the law as established by this court. And this court.
You're admitting that the federal statute didn't prohibit it?
Oh, yes, absolutely, Your Honor.
Oh, okay, fine.
The UCMJ.
Okay, because in your brief, you go on about trying to imply it. You talk about congressional findings. You talk about all this other stuff. Now you're conceding that the statute didn't prohibit it.
Yes, Your Honor, and I don't think.
Okay. Then we don't need to talk about this anymore.
It was never the government's intent to imply that there was a federal statute in effect in 2006 that prohibited the viewing of child pornography. It'd be much easier if it was. It wasn't until 2 years later.
What do you do, and I think that this is related to what Judge Stuckey was asking about, is if you have a federal statute that lists 20 different things that are illegal related to child pornography, and viewing is not included, how do you balance that apparent, you know, lack of notice or suggestion that is okay, that viewing it is okay, against the fact that there may be a state statute or two that says the opposite?
Well, Your Honor,
I mean, and I'm not suggesting that, you know, that a reasonable person or that I would think, oh my gosh, well, this is fine, but I'm just saying the fact that it's not listed and all the other acts are seems to be sort of a negative presumption.
Right. Obviously, the government's job would be more easily done if that had been the case in 2006. But again, when I talk about the core concepts of criminality, which is a concept this court recognized, it looked at to what was the status of society. And it's, as we provided those statutes and those congressional findings and the state findings, every you know, Congress said in 1996 that the viewing of child pornography...
Well, now, wait a minute. It seems to me that now you're getting back to the argument that because Congress has prohibited various conduct in an area, that individuals should be on notice that conduct that wasn't prohibited but that was associated with it is illegal. And how do you support that? Can an individual be charged? Could an individual in 2006 been charged under federal law for viewing?
No, absolutely not.
And so what notice can they take from all of this congressional action or anything else?
Well, let me first distinguish, when you talk about federal laws, you mean federal code outside the UCMJ. I believe they could not have been charged under the federal statute at that time, the CPPA, for viewing child pornography. But there are many things we charge people within the UCMJ that someone could not be charged under federal statute.
With proper notice.
With proper notice, yes. Okay. And I agree that notice is the question. And the real question is, did this airman honestly have a fair expectation of viewing the consumption, the use of child pornography?
So far, the most relevant document or the most relevant law that's been put on the table is federal law. And you're conceding that it did not cover viewing.
Right.
And then every time you try to bring... I want to go back to the parade of gerunds just because it's so entertaining. But just trying to visualize it. But you've pointed to state law, or what are you pointing as the counterweight to that federal law?
State law. And
but in your brief, I maybe misread it, but I was having a hard time finding a parade of gerunds that included viewing.
It
was like one state or something.
I believe both sides concur that at the time of this offense, there was at least seven states that had laws.
So the seven states somehow provides the notice that the federal law doesn't. Are you suggesting that the manual or somehow, is there some way that someone would have been on notice that because it was discredit, you're more broadly on notice?
Absolutely. Your
Honor. Okay, where's that come from? Because state law doesn't say this is discrediting.
Correct.
So where are we getting the discredit knowledge?
Well, I think it's clear from what this court has said. Again, in Bivens, they specifically talk about bigamy. And they say that even though there was no common law prohibition against bigamy, that no fair and reasonable military member could have thought committing bigamy was okay. I don't believe there's a federal statute against bigamy either.
So notice doesn't actually require then a particular category of notice. It could be found in the air.
It could be found in the six categories of this court.
Is it a brooding omnipresence in the sky?
Pardon me?
Is it a brooding omnipresence in the sky? It no, sounds like it.
Well, Your Honor, the government is clearly relying as the
government. The government is clearly relying on some sort of seepage from state statutes into the service discrediting consciousness of the average airman.
Well, what the government's relying on is this court's precedent in Bivens and Vaughn and Saunders, which all looked to state law to provide the notice. And it's not a concept that I came up with myself, but it's a concept that this court has enumerated in the past, and that's what the government's relying on. There has never been, as the court said, it was in Vaughn, the case law on this subject is scant. And I imagine that's why this court's taken the opportunity to address that. But it's the government's position that this goes to fair notice. Could this airman reasonably have believed that every other step in the distribution chain of child pornography was illegal for him? But the use of that very...
Now, wait a minute. You seem to be recurring to federal law now because you had your parade of gerunds, and that's all the steps. And then this step's not in there, and you're saying, well, he couldn't have believed that everything else was prohibited and this was allowed, was authorized. Well, not authorized. Was not prohibited.
Well, Your Honor, again, it comes...
Are you referring to federal law now?
Federal and state law.
Counsel, your argument is actually cutting against itself. If there's a statute that says you can't hop, skip, jump, run, walk, whatever, right? And it doesn't say that you can't, crawl, right? Why wouldn't you think you could crawl? If it listed every other type of movement, and you were like, well, I can crawl.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's very clear, as you look at the legislative history that we provided, that every one of these state statutes and the federal statutes that are now in effect, one at the time, were done to stop the exploitation of children, sexual exploitation of children.
But why would your average military member think that these were two distinct things? Which I think goes back to a question that Chief Judge Baker was asking, right? Which is possession, your viewing versus receiving. Well, don't you think that most people would think if they had it in their hand, if they received it in their hand, that that was the same, that, and they were looking at it, that they weren't two different acts?
I don't know if they would understand these two different acts, but I don't know if they would understand the difference between receipt and possession either. That by receiving it, somehow is distinct from possession. We clearly do delineate those two concepts. I do believe it's critical that that we understand that this reason we have child pornography statutes is to stop the sexual exploitation of children. Congress has recognized it. The states have recognized it. The sexual exploitation starts with the manufacture of that child pornography and ends with the use of that child.
Congress recognized it, and they didn't put it in the statute.
I wish they had, Your Honor, but they didn't.
Well, that's a decision for them.
Well, I would agree they did make that decision later, but I just also would state that this court has clearly looked to state law to determine 134 offenses.
Did Congress prohibit the viewing of child pornography in the 2008 amendment?
CPPA, they used language that I don't think was specifically said, but under the most recent version of the UCMJ.
I'm talking about the federal statute.
Right. They make reference view, and I can't remember the exact language.
Excessive child pornography. With the intent to view.
Right, that's
the
right.
Actual viewing is still not a crime under federal law.
Under federal law, but under Article 134, we have specific notice now that viewing is a crime under 134.
And why did you add that if, in fact, it was already, if people knew about it?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know why they added that other than to make it clear. I would say that, there's lots of times we've amended or changed laws that things were already covered. Almost everything in 134 probably had an origin of being charged under the general article, and when they saw it was occurring enough, they decided to specifically put it in.
Counsel,
go ahead.
My understanding of the reliance on state law in this area is that for most of this country's history, the states were the primary source of criminal law, and that one would look to state law to determine whether the average service member would know that this is the type of conduct that is criminalized in society. The state laws that are cited here address a variety of issues involving viewing, most of which involve viewing as proof of another offense, possession, receipt, etc. And for example, the Illinois statute that's cited in the government's brief and the case that's discussed there makes it clear that viewing itself is not a crime. For example, someone who buys a ticket, goes into a theater and watches a movie of child pornography, according to that case, would not be a crime in Illinois. So looking at the face of the charge in this case, in what states, either by name or by number, how many states would that charge have been a crime at the time the charged offense was committed here? I'm not talking about the states in which viewing could have been used as proof of another offense, but the charge on the face of it, where would that have been a crime?
I believe it's seven, Your Honor.
Seven states.
I believe. I think that's...
Seven states, mere viewing itself.
I believe that's correct.
Okay, we'll look at that. And in other states, there's case law that says that mere viewing is not a crime.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And in what other area would we look to where we'd have that kind of division as to where something would be permitted in a highly regulated area like this in which we've concluded that that it would constitute fair notice. Yeah, what other subject? In other words, we're looking, this is not a charge that has come up with respect to conduct that's not otherwise highly regulated. It's highly regulated at the federal and the state level, as you pointed out in your brief. And so what I'm looking at here is, if you have a highly regulated area that identifies what type of conduct is prohibited, are there other subjects in which we've said there's an Article 134 offense that would hold in a highly regulated area that's not addressed as being prohibited by most states and the federal government?
I imagine there is, Your Honor, but I could not tell you. If I may now turn to issue two in the last minute and a half here. In issue two, I think it's clear that the appellant's concern is the time that the Air Force Court took to resolve this issue. And this is not a case where either the defense is claiming that they took too long or that the government took too long in processing this, but in fact it's the Court of Criminal Appeals for the Air Force that took too long. Allison specifically talks about, and when we've broken the Marino standard, we can just look to whether or not there's prejudice beyond, is the harm is beyond reasonable doubt. And that is what the government suggests this court do, is just look to the harm is beyond reasonable doubt. The excessive oppressive confinement, I could be wrong, but I believe the accused was actually sentenced on 2 September 2009. The appellate brief tells us that he went on appellate leave for 16 months, and that was in August of 2012, which means he's released from confinement somewhere around April of 2011. Briefing wasn't completed in this case until 25 August of 2012. In other words, he'd been released from confinement before the Air Force Court even had the opportunity to review these cases. So there is no excessive or oppressive confinement. Additionally, as far as a rehearing, obviously if this court were to rule against us on issue one, there is no opportunity to rehearing. Either he had once or he didn't, and so there is no rehearing. Sex offender registration, regardless of how this court rules in this case, and I see my time's up, I'm going to finish my thought, regardless of how this court rules in this case as to issue one, the appellant will still be convicted, receive a child pornography, still have punitive discharge, and still have served the 2 years of sentence. So therefore, he will still have to be a registered sex offender, and there is no prejudice to the appellant, and that's proven beyond reasonable.
Counsel, would there be any prejudice to the government if we, sua sponte, took up the issue of unreasonable multiplication of charges and dismissed the charge on that basis, and otherwise affirm the sentence?
Well, I'll frame this, Your Honor, if I had the ability in my position to dismiss that charge, I would, because it's not worth the issue. He's going to be in the same exact position as he is.
Is your answer to my question yes?
Well, it would be prejudice in the sense that I have to speak to a bigger cause.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal, please.
Thanks, Judge. I see that the clerk has given me 5 minutes, but I'd use a couple of it, so we'll see how things go. Judge Ryan, I'd like to start with an analogy that you used of the hop, skip, and a jump. And Judge Baker, I seem to remember one time I used an analogy before you and failed miserably. I'm going to try a little better this time. I was thinking of an analogy in which everybody knows that it is illegal for somebody who is under the age of 21 to consume alcohol. It's illegal for them to buy alcohol, it is illegal for them to consume alcohol, and it is obviously illegal for them to drive a vehicle. It may be service discrediting for them to consume alcohol in front of their young child, for a 19-year-old to have a beer in front of a 2-year-old. That does not mean that it is illegal. So the mere fact that one is on notice that their behavior may be service discrediting does not put them on notice that it is illegal. But more importantly, and I think this goes to the analogy that I was just giving you, Chief Judge, is that the mere, is that, and in response to Judge Ryan's question, the fact that they prohibited A, B, C, D, and E would not put one on fair notice that E is illegal. And so I think that goes back to the popsicle jump, I believe, in the analogy that the Judge Ryan used. And then opposing counsel talks about this core concept of criminality, which goes to the very essence of this issue, judges, which is that if Congress does not say it is criminal, how in the world does a reasonable person know? And viewing is not consumption. In fact, as you recall, during the trial in this case, the military judge had to go back and look at Black's Law Dictionary for the definition of receipt. That is what this case centered on, was the entire issue of receipt.
So, counsel, is it? I assume that it's possible to receive without viewing. That is, if one accesses a site and says, if you want child pornography, download here. Probably wouldn't say it that expressly, but message conveyed there, if somebody downloads it without viewing it, could they be convicted, knowingly downloading it, could they be convicted of receipt even if they've never viewed it?
Judge, I forget the court, the decision from this court. I know that there is a decision from this court that is on that point, and the court talks about taking ownership of it, and that there would have to be some form of ownership of it, and I don't believe in that scenario that there would be.
Season.
Yeah, I believe that is, yes, Judge. And Judge, but subject to any further questions by the members of the court as it relates to assignment of Issue 1, there is just one brief thing I would like to touch on as it relates to assignment of Issue 2, which is if we take, if we look at this case from the standpoint of what is the remedy, and the judge has talked, and the government has talked about the dismissal of Specification 2 and all of that, as it relates to the assignment of Error 1, there is still the issue of what remedy should be availed to the appellant for the unreasonable delay in this case. With all due respect to my opposing counsel, this is not so much a question of an unwarranted windfall for the appellant, but it is actually an unwarranted windfall for the government should this court do nothing. The government messed this case up, and I don't mean Mr. Christensen or Colonel Christensen, rather, or Mr. Bruce, but they obviously stand in the shoes of the bigger government. The government messed this case up, but the government suffers no consequences at all, according to the government, for depriving the appellant of his constitutional right to a speedy post-trial review. And with all the respect, members of the court, that sends a horrible message to appellants and to the field, that if an accused receives a relatively light sentence of confinement, then the government, whether it be at the trial level or the Air Force Court or wherever, drags its heels long enough, there is simply no relief. If there's no relief, then the government and the Court of Criminal Appeals have no incentive to adhere to Moreno and the speedy post-trial line of cases that it's fallen. And subject to any further questions from members of the court, and realize I'm not going to have visions of Jerry commercials in my head for the rest of the day, that concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you,
Judge. Court, thanks to both counsel, and the court will stand in recess until tomorrow. Thank you very much.
All rise. The court stands adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.